All right. Hi, everybody. My name is Dan Johnson. We are live on the air. It is Friday Morning Talk right here at KBOO 90.7. I want to thank Mike Hoffman, our engineer, and, of course, Kathleen Stevenson, the boss. So we are going to be talking about a subject that is near and dear to my heart, something that is probably of major importance that many of us face. Not unlike many other people, I grew up poor, really poor, let me tell you. We did not have a lot, and what little we did have, we learned to appreciate. But times have changed since the Federal Housing Project in West Long Beach in the late 40s and early 50s. You know, 5 years ago, people thought that they were safe in their job, secure in their home, hopefully setting a little bit aside. For the most part, never thought they would be unemployed for 12, 18, 24 months or more, and never considered the word foreclosure would be a part of their vocabulary. But it did happen, and things changed, and these things change a sleep, and with these things, a sleeping giant has reared its ugly head called hunger. Hunger is our topic for today. It is gnawing away at our society in such an insidious way that it creates hardships on families, creates havoc on the economy, and adds yet more burden on our struggling school systems. And the sad realization is that there are those in this country, in this state, in this county, even in Portland, that suffer because of the lack of food. Solving this problem is not one single person's responsibility, but it is all of our responsibilities to see that those that are experiencing a lack of food on a daily basis have those needs met. We're going to be opening the phone lines in just a little bit and welcoming your call. But first, I want to welcome our guest, Jessica Chenet. Jessica is Deputy Director of Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon, and she has a wealth of knowledge and experience in feeding hungry Oregonians. Welcome, Jessica.
Well, thank you so much for having me here this morning.
Okay. In thinking about food and hunger, okay, one of the terms that in setting the kind of ground rules that we're looking at, there is a term that we've been running across for a while, and I believe it's in your material, and Oregon Food Bank talks about it, and a lot of other agencies talk about it, and that is being food deprived or food lacking in food. What does that generally mean?
Well, I think the term that you might be thinking about is food insecurity. Is that
perfect?
The one? Yes.
Perfect.
We do get a lot of confusion around that term, and it's a term that the U.S. Department of Agriculture uses. And every year they do a survey where they assess food security in our country. And a food secure family is one household is one that has enough food for an active, healthy life. And that is the majority of households in our country. But there is a percentage of households that are experiencing food, what they call low food security. And those are families that are not necessarily sure where their next meal is going to come from. They're not sure they're going to have enough food. They're also employing different types of coping mechanisms. So perhaps they're going to a food bank to get some food, or they're on food stamps, or what's called SNAP now, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or they're eating with family members. Perhaps they're not eating food that is as nutritious as they once had because they're starting to change their buying habits because they just don't have enough money. Now, there's another term that's used, and it's called very low food security, and that really is the hunger that we're talking about. And these are the folks that are skipping meals. They're reducing the size of their meals. Sometimes they're going hungry for whole days. It used to be they called that food insecurity with hunger, but now the USDA has a couple years ago changed that to very low food security. But the anti-hunger advocates that work in this field, we still call it hunger.
Okay. The reason I wanted to lay the groundwork with that definition was because when we open the phone lines, I would like our callers to just kind of give a response to this question, and that is, have you ever not known where your next meal would come from. And that's kind of a we're playing musical microphones now. So if you've ever been in that situation where you have not known where your next meal would come from and how you would cope with that situation, give us a phone call. The lines are open at 231-8187. Give us a call. Let's talk about that a little bit. And while we're waiting for our first caller, these are some statistics, Jessica, that I've picked up, and perhaps you might want to speak to them. More than 240,000 people per month ate meals from an emergency food box, that compares to about 200,000 in 2007-2008. That's a pretty startling statistic in itself. Would you say that that increase is due to the economy?
Most definitely, yes. And earlier you mentioned that we've kind of had a sleeping giant that woke up, this hunger issue. And it's true that things have gotten to a larger proportion, and in effect that has kind of woken up a lot of people that wouldn't normally think about this problem because they themselves are experiencing, or maybe they're worried about it because of their job security, or they're just knowing more people in their family and friendship network, people that are struggling with it now that didn't used to. However, we've had a problem with hunger in Oregon for quite some time now, and in the year 2000, we were first in the nation for a high percentage of hungry people. So we've been really focusing on this issue for quite some time, but recently we've seen many more people find themselves in this situation, and now they're struggling, and they're having to find a way to make ends meet and make sure that their children don't go hungry.
Okay, one of the things I would like to do, we mentioned this a little bit ago off air, is because of the work that you do, and because of the work that Oregon Food Bank does, you're not in competition with each other, but you both serve a vital role. What is the distinctive difference?
Oh, yes. So Partners for Hunger Free Oregon is a nonprofit organization that actually emerged from the Oregon Hunger Task Force. Now, that is a task force that was created by the legislature in 1989 to focus on the issue of hunger. And we operate in a complementary role with the Oregon Food Bank. Oregon Food Bank, its primary mission is to feed people who are experiencing food insecurity and hunger. And they mainly do that through a distribution network across the state where people can get food boxes and emergency meals and other types of food through different outlets. Our program is not a direct feeding organization. We do two things primarily. One is we work on federal food program outreach, so making sure that people across the state are aware of the federal nutrition assistance programs that were designed to address the hunger issue. So we're talking about food stamps or SNAP or the child nutrition programs such as school meals, summer food programs. The other thing we do is we really work on the prevention of hunger. So Oregon Food Bank mainly hits it after someone is hungry. We're really trying to go upstream and prevent the issue in the first place. So we work on public policy that helps low-income people be able to get more money in their households so that they can afford their bills.
I want to talk about that public policy again in a little bit, but I understand we have a caller on line one. Liamaka, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Thank you for the call.
You're welcome.
What is your experience with hunger? Tell us your story.
Well, right now I'm a grandmother. I have three children, grandchildren, and one daughter. I grew up in rural Oregon, but also in Northern California in small towns. My mother was a single parent, and there were many, many times when we came home from school, and there wasn't even, there was nothing in the cupboard, and I do mean nothing. We didn't have any stuff to make a pancake or biscuits or anything. I remember that very clearly. I knew food would be coming, but I also knew that I would come home from school hungry most days. Currently, I work in sustainability. I'm helping to grow food. But also, my children and my grandchildren have experienced homelessness in the last year and a half, three different times, and have been on the verge of homelessness. And we access the food banks because the food stamps we get do not go far enough. So I have a growing concern for this. I'm seeing that there's a desperate need for a much larger mobilization in terms of planting food everywhere. So I just want to encourage people, and I do support the Oregon Food Bank. So thank you.
And Liamaka, if I may ask you, at what point in your life did things turn around the corner where you were not as worried about food as being a part of your daily occurrence?
When I left home and could go to work for myself, I went off to school on the federal dollar, and I was able to work, and as part of my schooling, I got food on a regular basis. But I also went to work and made a little money so I could buy extra things for myself. So my so most of my adult life as a working person, I had food security. I knew I could spend my money on food or whatever I wanted. If I wanted to go hungry and get something, that was a choice I could make, and it wasn't a hardship. But when I became a parent and was working and struggling to create a home, you know, that's when, again, things got really tight, and I did a lot of things to make sure I got food on the table that I would have gotten in some serious legal trouble for if I had been caught. Mm-hmm. But I did what I had to do, like many of us do.
Sure. Thank you very much for your call. I appreciate
it.
And thanks for adding to the conversation. Okay. A question again that we're concerned with is, have you ever not known where your next meal would come from? Phone line is open. 503-231-8187. And I understand we have a caller on line one again. Hi, Joanne.
Yeah, listen, folks. You know, we've been having programs like this for years, maybe a generation more. I'm writing about this serious issue. You know what folks need to get? We need to do what they're doing in Wisconsin. You got to do a lot more than talking about it and writing about it, because it's not going away. And that's what we have to do.
Well, let me ask you, did our caller go away? That's okay. Thanks, Joanna. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'd just like to respond to that a little bit. I do think that this is an issue that our whole state really needs to pay attention to. I mean, when you look at the statistics about what happens when children in particular go hungry over an extended period of time, it really is quite dire. They don't do as well in school. They don't do as well in their social networks. There's one statistic in particular that's very startling, and that is that teenagers in food insecure households are 5 times more likely to attempt suicide. So this is a critical issue that all of us really need to pay attention to. But I also want to point out that in our society, you know, there's a great deal of shame around not being able to provide for your family. And so I find that people, they're not as willing to talk about their experience because they feel like it's a very private thing.
Well, it is personal.
Mm-hmm.
It is. But, you know, my contention is that those things were in the past. And for many of us, we've moved beyond them. And we need to be able to talk about some of those things because they were a good lesson for the future, too. Now, the Partners for Hunger Free Oregon have a battle plan, if you will, that is extending out to the year 2015. You've implemented that plan. How does that address some of the needs that this last caller was experiencing? And before you answer that, I want to remind you, if you're listening, our topic is hunger. Have you ever not known where your next meal would come from? Give us a call. Tell us your story. The phone number is 503-231-8187. Go ahead.
Yeah, Partners for Hunger Free Oregon, at our website, www.oregonhunger.org, you can find our 5-year plan for the state of Oregon, and we have 3 primary goals. And I'm going to kind of go through them backwards if I could. The third goal is around improving the food assistance safety net, and that is around being able to get the emergency food box when a family needs it, or get access to a congregate meal site, or to get onto SNAP food stamps when they need those. We need to make sure we have a strong safety net in place so that we can feed people immediately when they need it. Goal 2 is around cultivating a strong regional food system, because when we know when there's a strong food system in place, that helps low-income people as well. So protecting our farms and our food processors and make sure we have a local food supply, all those things are very important, and there's a lot of recommendations around that goal. And the first goal, which is the one that our organization focuses primarily on, is making sure that families have economic stability. And we also want the state to have economic stability, too, because we see what happens when they don't, when it doesn't. They do things like cutting programs that are really important. And when families experience that economic instability, they end up cutting things that are really important, like their food budget. So we need to make sure that we have that economic stability in place if we're ever going to wrap our arms around this issue.
Well, I want to ask sort of a broader question, if I can. And I want to go back to our last caller. She was short and sweet. But, you know, we have all of these agencies. We have all of these services. We have all kinds of plans and proposals in line. But yet, we're still facing this dilemma. Why is it that we can't achieve that overall goal of eliminating food insecurity?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is, do we have the political will to really tackle the really tough issues that we know are causing the problem in the first place? So lack of living wage jobs, that's a huge, huge topic for the nation and for our state in particular, where we have a lot of low-wage service sector jobs that just don't pay families enough to afford all their bills. A lot of families have high childcare costs. They have high rental costs. Their utilities take a big bite. You know, all these things we have to wrap our arms around if we're going to really make a difference. So do we have the political will to really impact those issues? The second thing is there's just a lot more people in need right now due to the economy and what's happened over the past several years. So we've really had to mobilize to try and keep up. So, yes, we have a very strong infrastructure in place, but it needs to be stronger. But I think along with that, we need to start questioning, do we only want to put our energy into developing that infrastructure and not looking at what's causing the problem in the first place? So we really have to do it simultaneously.
A lot of education involved then.
This is very true.
All right. We have a caller on the line. Mitchell, thanks for the call.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
A little bit about hunger. As a child, I knew a little bit about hunger, me and my siblings. Being hungry and carrying around a pocket full of dry oatmeal, okay? Something to satisfy your need for the day. I think our society has been disinformed on a lot of things. A lot of the hungry people need jobs. Our country needs to start manufacturing again. And we need to start feeding not only our bodies, but our minds also. And part of this, I believe, if we would start researching and manufacturing from hemp.
Mm.
And it's my understanding that you can also produce food from hemp other than the other, you know, clothes. I mean, it just goes on forever.
So it's just another resource.
Well, I think hemp is a resource, and quit demonizing it and lock everyone in this mindset that it's taboo.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, science.
Let me ask you a question, Mitchell, if I may. Have you passed that point in your life where you were food insecure?
Well, yes, but it's on a daily basis. To make sure that the kids eat first, okay? I'm still a father/grandfather, and to keep meals, healthy meals,
mm-hmm.
okay, other than just a 365-day-a-year diet of hamburger helper, we need to do something in our nation to produce jobs and manufacture and get back on our feet.
Well, I think you bring up a good point because nutrition has really stepped forward in terms of providing nutritious meals for families is really becoming more prominent, if I'm not mistaken, Jessica.
Oh, yes, definitely. There's much more focus on nutrition, particularly with the obesity issue, but also the high prevalence of childhood diabetes. So we know that there are some very strong links between adequate nutrition and healthy children. Unfortunately, what we're seeing is that children that are experiencing hunger and food insecurity are going two directions. One, they're malnourished, so their bodies and minds are not developing normally. But also there is a connection between hunger and obesity. So we're mm-hmm. actually seeing hunger manifest itself in terms of obesity, which is kind of an interesting paradox when you think about it.
Right. You know, I want to share a brief story. When I was a kid, we lived in Northern California at the time, and times were really tough. So my mom would go down to the meat market, and she would buy these turkey carcasses. And she'd try to find the turkey carcasses that had the most meat on it, but she would bring those turkey carcasses home. And I've got to tell you that from those turkey carcasses, she would make turkey soup, turkey casserole, turkey this, turkey that. We had turkey like it was going out of style, but they were very inexpensive meals. And, you know, and I still like turkey today. But it was a memory that, you know, when other kids were having a wide variety of meals at home, we were stuck to this one particular diet, but we learned to appreciate it. Hey, Mitchell, thanks for the call. Okay, so with this plan that you have, what do you see as the way that education is implanted? Where do you go first to educate people?
Well, we've taken an approach with our most recent. We did have a 5-year plan before this one that we actually made some significant progress on. But I think the one thing that we weren't able to do as much of is really get out into the public and let them know that this plan existed. Because, like you said earlier, it takes all of us. We can't think that because there's a few anti-hunger organizations in place that they've got the issue covered and then everyone needs to just go on about their lives and not worry about it. This problem is insidious and it's affecting all of us. At the beginning of our plan, we talk about some of the issues around hunger and really the high cost of it. There was a study that was done that found that hunger costs us, our state, $1.2 billion each year, and we pay for that in a variety of ways, mainly through higher health care costs, through having to put money into a food assistance infrastructure, lost opportunities. I mean, we all pay for this problem, so we all need to focus on addressing it. And so we have hired a person. Her name is Robin Johnson, and she is going out throughout the state and talking to different communities and different governmental entities, but just also different community members about the issue and asking them to engage and play a role in addressing it. Now, a lot of people are, I want to give credit to the folks that are addressing this issue throughout the state. And there is a lot of activity that's going on around, primarily around direct food assistance and holding food drives and planting community gardens and things like this. And all of those are critically important. But there is still a large population that isn't aware that the problem exists and they haven't been engaged
right.
in a meaningful way.
Now, I want to shift gears just slightly here. And this is for our listeners. If you have been helped by an agency that supplies food either through a pantry or kitchen, and you want to share that experience, give us a call, 503-231-8187. The reason I bring this up is there's another startling statistic that just rocked my head. The Oregon Food Bank reports that 3.8 million emergency meals were served by soup kitchens and shelters in 2009. If that's not a startling number, I don't know what would be. And that's just in Oregon.
Yes. And again, I think it's really interesting to note that kind of need is going on and that kind of that level of meals are being served, and yet a lot of people still don't know that. And I think, again, it goes back to, are people comfortable sharing the fact that they are going to a soup kitchen? A lot of times people don't want to admit to that, and they just kind of quietly go and feed their families.
I'll be honest with you. I live in a retirement building, and there are a number of people in my retirement building that take advantage of Meals on Wheels. They go to Lowe's and Fish's. And so they would be accounted, or they would be counted among that 3.8 million. So it you know, they're people that are around us all the time. And so I just found it totally mind-boggling that it had reached that 3.8 million. So to the listener out there, if you've ever been served by one of the agencies that provides food and you've taken advantage of it, we want to hear from you and we want to talk about that experience. 503-231-8187. 3.8 million. Can you believe that?
Yeah, and I did want to, I need to check and make sure, but from my understanding, that figure does not include Meals on Wheels and other governmental, like the Senior Nutrition Meal okay. Program that the government funds. I think that is just mainly through the Oregon Food Bank Network, so that means food that they've gathered and distributed.
That could be true.
So it's probably a much bigger problem than what you're stating even.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's important to know as well.
Boy, oh boy.
Yes.
Shift, of course, is that among those that are facing hunger, and we've touched on it lightly, 33% of those who are going hungry in Oregon are children. Now, based on the information that you provided at your website, just to kind of bring it home so that you can really get the picture, in Multnomah County, there are about 17%, and I'm going off the top of my head here, about 17% of those that are in the poverty level are children from ages 0 through 18. And I, you know, so it is a real thing. So it doesn't happen over in just Clatsop County or down in Lane County. It's right here in our own back door.
It is right here. It's all over the state, and it's a huge problem. And I think, you know, it's worth taking a small moment to just talk about the poverty level. Even the government acknowledges that 100% of the poverty level is way too low to really describe the need that goes on. And that's why schools serve children free and reduced price meals up to 185% of the federal poverty level. And we know that there's even children beyond that measurement that are struggling, families that are having a difficult time feeding their whole family, and children are going hungry as a result. So whenever we bring up the federal poverty level, it's one measurement, but it's not like you get like 1 cent over it and suddenly you're not poor and you're not struggling.
Right.
So we really need to, you know, be realistic about those measurements.
I have read several places where there is talk where they need to revamp what constitutes the poverty level.
There is a national discussion going on about that, and it looks like there is some movement in that direction, and so we're very hopeful that they'll be able to get a more accurate measurement.
We have a caller on the line right now. Barbara, thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a couple of suggestions. At a recent meeting of the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, I was given a brochure about SNAP, and I guess a lot of people don't know that's the latest name for food stamps. And it was said that a lot of money is sitting in that program unclaimed because people don't know to ask for food stamps or to know what SNAP is. So you might publicize that, or I guess
okay.
I just did.
What do you know about SNAP?
Just that it's the latest. I don't know much.
Okay.
It's just the latest name for the food stamp program. And I think they give a little card so that people don't have to tear up stamps anymore, but they just put a little card through
okay.
at the grocery so they won't be embarrassed.
Well, Barbara, we have the expert here,
good.
Jessica will be able to define that for you. I thank you very much for your call.
I have one more idea.
Okay.
A little more labor-intensive, but if a person gets a hold of a composter, Metro sells them for something like $35 from time to time, or I guess the local hardware store. So I turn my garbage into compost. Put my garbage out there every day, and then mix it with leaves or straw.
Sure.
And in the springtime, you dig it into the garden and grow your own vegetables.
Absolutely. That's a great idea, and it's been around for a long time.
Yeah, I just wanted to remind people.
All right. We've got two calls behind you, Barbara. Thank you very much. Hang on just a second, Jessica. Let's go to the next caller. Boris, thanks for the call.
You're welcome. I appreciate this is a topic that doesn't get addressed nearly as often as it should. And your number of 3.8 million meals a year. You know, that's kind of an overwhelming number for a lot of people to think about, but I just punched up the calculator. That's about 10,400 a day at a 365-day year. So that's a lot of people, folks.
It is, and to think that, you know, somehow or another, there are that many people that rely on that type of service to get their food. It is really a battle cry, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of let's get something better done.
Well, agreed. A lot of this is there's a big political subset to this, where the money is moving to the top in our society and away from real jobs and social service net is being cut so vigorously, and it just seems like of the country is moving in the wrong direction politically.
Well, I think if we start thinking about the direction we need to go, and as Jessica has suggested, there needs to be a stronger form of education sent not out not only to agencies but to the general public as well. That might be at least a small step in the right direction. Boris, thank you for your call.
One other short thing. You talked earlier about kids that are in food
insecure,
being more inclined for suicide and self pain, and there's also brain development in children. I don't know if you've talked about that, but maybe your guest could address that a little bit in smaller children where they just don't get nutrition and they have brain development that is totally inhibited and doesn't recover.
Right. No. I think that's great, and I think we're going to try to squeeze that in. We have one more caller. Boris, thank you very much. Caller number, are you there?
David,
thank you for waiting.
So we're talking about good stuff here, and it just really just flabbergasts me and makes me just disgusted with my own country and my own species on this planet. I think what's going on here is it's robbing from the poor, making themselves richer and richer and richer, and I think the rich should be obligated and should have it within their consciousness to take some of their gross earnings and some of their gross theft of finance and money. There should not be any poor people in this whole entire world. I mean, there's so much money that these guys have. This guy in Mexico that's the richest man in the world. There's the Microsoft guy, and then there's Buffett, and then there's all these people that are billionaires, and there's people poor. And it's, even if you take one of these guys that made $1 billion from the bailout, thank you very much, and you took just a quarter of that and gave $1,000 a person to all the people that are poor, you
well,
know,
Richard,
rich.
I think on one hand I could kind of agree with you, but when you start talking about
agree, we have a social obligation to each other
we do, but I just want to clarify one thing. You know, Warren Buffett has announced that he feels that it is important for people in his circle of wealth that they take responsibility and they pay their fair share.
And so,
you know, I think that there are many out there that do not and are and should take responsibility, but
well, I think what we should do is we should go after them. What we need to do is we need to go after our money. We need to get some cojones, and we need to go after it, and we need to start standing up for ourselves. But here's the real thing is when you have children starving, their body organs aren't forming properly. Their body organs still grow till the age of 12. Their brain isn't developed yet. So now you're creating cancers, heart diseases, fibromyalgia, fibromatosis. These are all being created at the child at 9 and 8 years old.
Right.
These are all being created for 40-year-old problems.
Okay.
So what we have to look at, got to educate the people and say, listen, you've got all this money. Yeah, you earned it. But we have an obligation, and what was really cool is there was some CEOs on that are making like $500 million a year, and he's going, I wish, And this is really cool. There's a group of rich people that are actually wanting to give more money, Buffett, for example, and stuff. But they're saying, listen, I need to be taxed at 60%. I need it. That's what they're requiring. And the people in Congress and Senate aren't listening to the rich people, which is really amazing, too. So
absolutely.
We're just kind of walking around in
Richard, case. I want to thank you. I want to thank you for your call, Richard. And I've got two other calls behind you.
Sure.
Thank you very much. All right. We have another caller on the line. Ryan, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'm one of these people that have, in the last 3 years, I've gone from a pretty comfortable six-figure income to pretty much poverty. And my cooking skills, learned from my mother, have helped a lot recently. I'm writing a little book about it, in fact, called... it's called Survival Cooking for the Riffraff, and I don't know how long it's going to take me, but I'm putting it all down. And, you know, I'm horrified at the waste that comes out of not just restaurants, but, you know, just people in America have no idea how to make things last. It's been educated out of them, I think, by a winner-take-all society and poor education. I mean, I don't throw anything away. I make stocks from my vegetable peelings.
Do you compost?
Huh?
Do you compost?
Yeah. I mean, plus, when I'm finished with something, and it usually gets a couple of times run through whatever, you know, stock. I mean, you can make hash browns from potato peelings if you wash them and dry them and freeze them, you know, chop them up.
There's fiber there, too.
Yeah, there's all sorts of things. And, you know, bones. When I'm finished with it, the crows get it, you know. But
you know what you ought to think about doing is you ought to think about putting a cooking session together to teach people some basic cooking skills.
Oh, yeah, and people come to my house and they're amazing. I mean, just even when we're sort of okay, and it's a real struggle right now. I mean, I get a good part of my meat from a local farmer and local, you know, sometimes a trade with local vegetable farmers. And you know, I know we're quite lucky where we are because we live in a fairly fertile area. But
right.
In the cities, there can be, you know, like, communities helping each other, and I wish there'd be more vegetable gardens and less parking spaces in places like Portland.
All right. Hey, listen, I hate to cut you off, but we have the phone lines are just going crazy. And
well, that's good.
Yes, absolutely. So,
winner-take-all society doesn't work.
Right, and I applaud you for your self-reliance. I think that's a good thing.
It's hard, but it works.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks again. Before we go to our next caller, I want to remind you our guest Jessica Chimney is here. And Jessica, you've heard a myriad of things in the last few minutes. What strikes you?
Oh, there's several things, but I'll pick it up kind of where our last caller left it off, and that is to say I think the lack of cooking skills is something that our society is dealing with in general, but it's hitting the poor the hardest because when you find yourself in that situation, suddenly you've got to become very resourceful. But many of them do, and as you stated earlier, mother got very creative about the food that she had and what she could do with that, and we see that among the people that get into that situation as well. On the other hand, though, we do have to acknowledge that a great many of people that are experiencing hunger and food insecurity are families with small children, and they're working sometimes two jobs, and they're trying to juggle the kids and many other responsibilities, and the time is simply not there to do a lot of the things that would create a healthier food environment within their household, like going to the farmer and getting those kinds of food and working a garden. I mean, certainly there is an opportunity to do some of that, but it's not the same, and so we have to kind of think about all the different situations that families that are faced with when they get into that situation. I did want to mention that the earlier caller mentioned SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is now the new name for food stamps. You are allowed to buy seeds and starts with SNAP. So you can buy those kinds of things that help a person grow their own food. So that's something that many people don't realize. But she mentioned publicizing the program in general. Oregon actually is doing pretty good. We have 760,000 people realize we only have 3.7 million in our state, are now on SNAP. That's one in five people. And that has almost doubled since before the recession. So a lot of people are aware of it, but there are still a lot of people that are not. And when we look at the recent survey that the Oregon Food Bank did, we found that about half the people getting food boxes are not on SNAP. And that is a population that definitely qualifies. And so we do have some work to do to get out there and educate people about that program.
Right. And we also have to go to the next caller who has been patiently waiting. Sean, thank you for waiting.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I often run into kind of a awkward situation. I'll talk to people about the need for socialism and the need to abolish free markets and capitalism. And often the response I get is, oh, that's such a broad topic, and it's so unrealistic, and it's so big. You know, you need to focus on narrower issues. And what I always respond with is, so long as we silo all of these individual agendas, nothing is ever going to change. Talking about these issues as if they're separate, whether it's homelessness, hunger, treatment of the mentally ill, the healthcare system in general, American foreign policy, so long as we continue to silo these issues, that's just a completely unrealistic and an irresponsible path to pursue, and nothing is ever going to change until we take on capitalism itself. And a quick note on Warren Buffett, by the way. There's a brilliant documentary out there called The 1%. It was made by one of the heirs to the Johnson & Johnson family fortune. And in the film, one of the adopted daughters of Warren Buffett agreed to participate in exposing the grotesquely opulent lives of the rich. And Warren Buffett actually disowned one of his own adopted daughters because she agreed to participate in this film. And I would simply conclude by saying that human beings are to capitalism what firewood is to the fireplace. We simply are never going to be able to negotiate with this capitalist system or with the capitalist class. We will never solve any of our problems. We are the fuel for this monstrosity. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for the call. A quick thought here. A number of years ago, Lou Dobbs wrote a book called War on the Middle Class. And it ties in, and I don't agree with Lou Dobbs politically. That's just the way it goes. But his book was right on in sort of stating that there is an ever-eroding effect going on with the middle class today. And that middle class is bore out in this recent survey from the Oregon Food Bank, where it points that the poor continually are getting poorer. And these are people that were at one time average, everyday, middle-class people like you and me. Jessica.
Well, I just wanted to mention that we do have a political system in place, and we do have people that are supposed to represent our interests. And I think one of the things that as a society we don't do enough of is hold them accountable. When we think about the hunger issue, I think we think about what can we do today, and holding a food drive or planting a garden is the kind of thing that we feel like we can actually handle, and many people do that, and that's critically important. However, hold a food drive, plant a garden, and call your legislator. Talk right to them about the hunger issue. Ask them what they're doing. Ask those tough questions and then demand accountability. Keep coming back and ask those questions. I think if we keep missing that critical piece, we're going to continue to see this problem grow.
It's that old squeaky wheel thing. Absolutely. Right. We do have a caller on line one. Terry, thanks for calling.
Hey, excellent show today.
Thank you.
I do want to agree with you on one point, that the chasm between the rich and the poor is growing. And primarily, I think the reason that is happening is, number one, I think the middle class is being taxed too much. Number two, remember my grandpa once told me that if you took all the wealth in the world from the wealthy and you spread it out evenly amongst everybody, it would only be a matter of a couple years between that the poor would be poor again, the wealthy would be wealthy again. And the reason why, and I said, Grandpa, why? He said, the reason why is because those people who are wealthy, they know how to earn money. They work hard. They're not lazy. And a lot of the poor people today, the entitlement society, wants something for nothing. And I think that's why you see the attack on the wealthy, on the rich today, is because you have a society, and if that society is close to 30% today in America, They don't want to work. They want to hang out at Starbucks and maybe be on the internet and get something for free because they're lazy.
Hey, let me ask you a question.
You bet.
Have you ever faced hunger?
No, because I'm a very, very hard worker. I'm not a wealthy person. I own my own business. I make a decent living. And when times have been tough like in the last 3 years, I have worked very hard to make extra money. I have never, ever, ever, ever taken a dime from the government for anything.
Congratulations. I appreciate it. And
but
thank you.
You know what? I'm not patting myself on the back, okay?
Yeah, no, that's fine.
I'm extremely hard worker, but I really, listen, I really mean what I say. We have an entitlement society today. I realize there are poor people, and I help the poor. I give 15% of my wealth away on a monthly basis, and I can prove that. However, there are people today that are well-bodied, that are just damn lazy and do not want to get and they expect a handout.
All right. Hey, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. We got a couple of people waiting. Jessica, just before we go to the next caller, it looked like you wanted to jump in there and say something.
I would like to jump in. And I think, I mean, we all have our own perspectives, and he's certainly entitled to his own. But I think that the way he is characterizing the issue is exactly what creates the stigma that people are battling with that are also struggling with hunger. They know they're going to be judged and judged harshly for accessing programs or for going to a food pantry. And that's why they don't talk about those issues. And I would argue that vast majority of people that are in that circumstance, they're really stressed out and they're working very hard. I mean, it is not easy to be poor. And when you just look at the basic figures in terms of what minimum wage pays, I mean, minimum wage pays less than 100% of the poverty level for a family of three. And when you do the math, you cannot pay your rent and your utilities and your childcare bills and your transportation and also afford food. You just can't do it unless you're going to double up or you've got support from your family. So I think that it's not necessarily a matter of not working hard. It's a matter of what you have to work with, what our opportunities are in our society.
Right. And just to back that thought up, one of the other statistics that kind of smacked me upside the head was 64% of households with children had income below the federal poverty level. So that says a lot right there in terms of those people that were facing the issue of hunger. I understand we have a caller on the line. Jack, thanks for holding.
That homily of Jerry's has been around for a long time, and I heard it when I was young too, I think from a civics or socials a teacher in high school or something, and what it overlooks, of course, is the means of attaining wealth and networking, and who your friends are, and that kind of thing. You know, I mean, if all your friends are other poor people, they can't do a heck of a lot for you to bring wealth to you. If your friends are all connected and have the means, then that's pretty much the way things get done. You know, nepotism and cronyism is the heart and soul of the capitalist system. But that's really not what I called to talk about. The SNAP program, which is supposed to be the safety net that keeps people from sliding under a bridge or whatever, mm-hmm. where you can't really get that program because you have to have a place to prepare your meals to be on that program. And once you've you're homeless, then you're at the soup kitchen.
I want to stop you right there because Jessica has a response to that. Go ahead.
Oh, I didn't know if maybe there was some confusion with that program and another one. But with SNAP, SNAP, as you called it, you don't have to have cooking facilities in order to get that program. Are you suggesting that you need cooking facilities just to be able to utilize the food that you purchase at the store?
Well, it seems to me, I was on that program, and I seem to recall in the application form that there is a question, do you have a place to prepare your food? And I thought that that question would be pertinent to qualification. Otherwise, it wouldn't be there.
I think you might be a little bit confused. I'm not sure what that form was. It's not a form that DHS would hand out, I can tell you that. They do ask questions about where you store your food and how you cook it, whether or not you cook for yourself, because that allows them to know how many people in the household are going to be eligible for the benefit. So, for instance, if you're in a roommate situation and you keep your food separate from your roommate, you are going to qualify as an individual household, even though you're living in the same space. Now, if you are blending your food, then you're going to be a two-person household. So I think there might have been some confusion around that question and what that meant. But you do not need to have a cooking facility to get on SNAP, not at all.
All right. Well, all right. So where I'm going actually is that if anybody been in the program and the reason I say was receiving the benefits is because they cut me off and I entered into a more than a year long. Administrative hearing process to get those benefits back. And when I see the amount of resources that has been put into denying those benefits, it really makes me wonder how efficient DHS is in actually qualifying people and getting the benefits out to people, because it seems to me, just from what I've seen, that they put more energy into denying, and they call it qualifying people, but you know it qualifying means disqualifying as much as qualifying, I think. And I know they complain, oh, I've got 500 cases, I've heard it before. Well, 500 cases that need to be recertified every 6 months. If you do the math, that's maybe four a day. So I find it hard to see how they can. It seems to me that they're expending a lot more energy on their a lot more expense in their staffing than they are in actually getting services to people.
That would be an interesting topic to follow up on. Unfortunately, I don't have an answer for that, and I don't think Jessica does right now either. But you bring up an interesting point, and I think it points to the bureaucracies that are layered that we sometimes have to jump through just to achieve those basic needs.
Yeah, and that is that program I think could be very, very much more effective. Keep people from sliding under a bridge or something. It's the feeling I get from it is that that's where they want you to be in order to get any help from them. They anybody who is near the poverty level where your qualification is questionable is their effort is to actually deny you. And to take this back to what the previous caller was talking about, there are a lot of people who are working very hard and struggling right at that poverty level. And to characterize these people as lazy and shiftless and worthless is what I heard in his voice. I would compare the ne'er-do-well wealthy who inherit their wealth and all of their ability to maintain and grow their wealth comes primarily through their networking, their connections in their privileged schooling system, not necessarily and probably not in particularly from their industry and initiative.
Okay,
leave there. Thank you.
I hate to cut you short, but we're going to have time for one more caller, but we're not ready for the caller just yet. Jessica, I want you to respond. I know you had a couple of thoughts there, and then if the caller will be patient and wait, we'll get to them, and that will be our last caller for this morning.
I did just want to acknowledge what's happening in our state with the Department of Human Services and the SNAP program. They administer SNAP. And those caseworkers also, the same caseworkers that administer SNAP also administer a lot of other programs. And so it would be a much higher number of cases that they're managing. I think there we can point to some success with that program in terms of the number of people that are on it. 1 in 5 people in Oregon, and our state in particular, has received bonuses from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for its high participation rate, so we are serving a lot of people. On the other hand, I don't want to discount his experience. He, you know, may be legitimately having some problems because it's a big system and you know, things happen. But we do have a pretty good system in place for trying to address those issues. I'm on a number of committees and some of my other staff are as well, where we bring forward complaints. And we do, in general, find a very receptive attitude to want from them wanting to change whatever needs to be done to address barriers. So I think it's a mix, but I think overall Oregon has done a pretty good job in trying to meet the needs of people that need that program.
Very good. Now, before we move too far forward, I have a couple of messages that I've got to share with the world. Coming up this morning on KBOO, you want to make sure you're listening at 9. It's Voices of the Middle East with host Gurdaz Ekhtadari. At 10, Air Cascadia headlines, interviews and commentary with Chris Andrea. At 10:15, Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, On the Digital Divide, Dave DeAngelis speaks with sustainability expert Alan Atkinson about how we can accelerate innovation to support sustainability goals. And Rabia Yemen speaks with Philip Howard about his book, The Digital Origins of Dictatorship and Democracy, Information Technology and Political Islam. And also, we don't want to close this in saying without saying thanks to KBOO members for your support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the tip jar. Now, to the caller who has been patiently waiting.
We have Beth next.
Beth, thank you very much for waiting.
I just wanted to comment. The question was asked, or the fellow who made the comment that he believed he saw on the application for getting food, the question was whether he had a place to cook the food. When I used to fill food boxes in Washington County, I would always ask when I made a food box if they had a kitchen or a facility to cook in. These were people coming to the door who got, I would go down and fill their food box, and I would also go and get the food at the food bank. But I gave them food that they could use if they did not have a facility for cooking. So that was the reason I asked the question, and that might be the reason that he saw that maybe that was a question on the application. If you can't cook it, you don't want to be receiving those types of foods.
Okay. Thank you very much for that call. The one thing that I picked out of that is that Washington County, I understand, is a largely growing county in terms of supplying food for people that need it because of the immense growth that's taken place in that area.
Yes, definitely. It is a high need area, and they recently have erected a new food bank over there to help address that need. I just wanted to clarify one thing, and that is with SNAP, which is the food stamps, that is a program where you get your food benefits on what's like a debit card, and you take it to the store, and so you're able to purchase.
It's the same as the Oregon Trail Card, isn't it?
It is the Oregon Trail Card. Yes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
People can go into the store and pick the foods that work the best for whatever their cooking circumstances are. So I just didn't want any confusion around that.
All right. Thank you very much. I want to thank Jessica Cheney, who is Deputy Director of Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon, for being our guest this morning. And thank you very much for your phone calls. Unbelievable. I was really surprised. And I think that's going to be it for Friday Morning Talk Radio. I know Jessica wanted to get something else in, but we don't have time. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll talk to you again soon.